And today we're going to be talking about Job. So I just want to encourage you to turn to Job 1. And if you're not sure where Job is, it's in the Old Testament. It's right before Psalms. So if you find Psalms, just flip back a book. We're going to study about a great man of God. We're going to be reading from Job 1. I'm going to read verses 1 through 12. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hand so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now Job isn't a story that most of us like to think about or talk about or even begin to understand, because it brings a reality to us that these kind of things happen in our lives. But we want to look at Job and who he is and what he went through, and what does that actually mean to you and I today? So as we look at Job, what does the scripture tell us about Job? It says he was blameless and upright. And I think of us, and if we were labeled blameless and upright, what a compliment to who we are and who God is in our lives to be called blameless and upright. Also says he feared God. And we talk about fearing God, we talk about having a reverence for God and who he is. So here was a blameless and upright man who feared God, who just revered who God was. Job was also very, very wealthy. He had thousands of sheep, camels, and other livestock, and he was blessed with a large family, 7 sons and 3 daughters. Well, 7 sons in itself at that time for that culture was a huge blessing, to have that many sons. God, to them, that looked like God was really looking down on him. It also said he was the greatest man among all the peoples of the East. Imagine having that label, being called the greatest man among all the people of the East. So as we read this, we see this description of who a godly man truly is in God's eyes, because this was God's description of him. But as we see in verse 6, the angels came to present themselves before God, and they were doing this to come and give an account of what they had been doing for God's kingdom, and also to receive instruction from God. But Satan came along with them, and Jesus questions him, "Where have you come from?" And what's interesting about this is Satan is obliged to answer him. He didn't say, "None of your business." He immediately responded to him. He says, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." And as we look at that, there's 2 things that we need to take away from that statement. Satan has no authority over God. God asked him a question, he had to respond to him. So Satan has no authority. When God spoke, Satan had to listen. And the second thing we want to realize is that Satan is roaming. And if he's roaming about the earth, he's looking for someone. He's looking for something. As you look at the name Satan, Satan means adversary or accuser. So if he's roaming, he's seeking to come up against somebody. He's seeking to accuse somebody of something. So he's up to no good. And God knows what he's doing. And he says in verse 8, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And when you read that, you think, what is he offering Job? Like, here he is, do with him whatever you want. But that's not what he was doing. What God was trying to show Satan is, this is a work of my grace. Here is a man who has lived an upright and holy life. This gives testimony to who I am. When you look at the rest of the verse, it says, "There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." God is giving us a picture of his glory, of who he is. He's pointing out Job as a creation of his grace and of his mercy. It's almost like a dad who, you know, he goes to his son's baseball game and the son is, you know, the all-star player, hitter, the whole thing. Look at my son. Look at how good he is. And this is what God is saying to Satan. Look how good my son is. What does Satan say to him? Well, of course. He has to be good. Look at all that you've blessed him with. You have given him such great wealth and blessing. Why shouldn't he be a man of God? Who wouldn't have all those wonderful attributes when they have those kinds of things that you've given them? So he challenges God to take everything away because he believes at that point is when Job's going to curse God. But notice, don't miss this, that he seeks God's permission to do it. He just doesn't say to God, well, you know what, I'm going to go do this. He asks permission. Satan is under God's authority. And God says, okay, but one condition, do not lay a finger on him. And look what happens when Satan gets that authority. His oxen and donkey are taken away. The sheep are burned up. Camels are taken. Servants are killed. And probably for me, as I read that, the greatest tragedy was the roof collapsing and all of his children being taken away from him. Imagine this happening to one man all at one time. Everything is gone. Think of how we would respond. But look at how he responded in verses 20 through 22. "At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised.' In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing." This affirms to Satan exactly what God was saying to him about who Job was. So as you go on to chapter 2, we have the same scenario again. And God responds the same way about Job. What does Satan do? Challenges God. "Skin for skin," Satan replied. This is verses 4 and 5. "A man will give all he has for his own life, but stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." So Satan's strategy didn't work the first time. Job still turned back to God. So he's saying, okay, I've taken everything away. There's only one thing left to do is to go after him physically. So he steps it up. Satan steps it up and God says, okay, but one thing. Again, God gives him permission. He says, spare his life. So Job is now afflicted with these sores. And we think, sores. But these were not what we would typically call sores. This was a disease that caused inflamed eruptions in the skin. It was accompanied by intense itching, and because of the conditions they were in, maggots would get into those sores. It would start to erode the bones, and the skin itself would start to turn black and start to fall off. So this was just not sores. This was a disease that eventually could kill somebody. So now Job is an outcast. He went from having it all to having nothing. His dwelling became probably what was called the town dunghill. He's lost it all, and now on top of that, he has this horrible disease. So he has now become an outcast. So not only has his life sunk to the lowest of lows, but then his wife gets involved, and she says in chapter 2, verse 9, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." This is his spouse. I mean, who'd want a spouse like that? You know, curse God and die. Not a good thing. Not a lot of support there. But what's interesting in that statement is even she recognizes his integrity. She sees that he is a man of God. But she's saying, curse God and die. And most of us probably at this point would want to, having everything taken away from us, our children, our wife saying what she did, and then having these sores, we probably would want to die. But what does he say to her? Verse 10, you are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Now think of what this must be doing to Satan. Satan's thinking, okay, I got him this time. He's going to curse God, and he's saying, shall we not accept bad? So this has to be frustrating him to no end, because he wanted him to curse God. So not only is Job dealing with all this, he's dealing with a lack of support from his spouse, but then three of his friends show up. Now most of us, if we were going through troubles and our friends show up, we would probably be very thankful. They wept out loud, tore their robes, and sprinkled dust on their heads, which was all a sign of mourning. In their eyes, they were probably thinking, you know, this guy doesn't have a whole lot of time left. He's our friend and we care, but it doesn't look too good for him. But for 7 days and nights, they sit with Job, and they don't say a word to him. They just sit there. Nobody talks. You think, wow, what kind of friends would that be, that I'm going through all this stuff and they're not even talking to me? But they sympathize with him in silence. They didn't talk. In the beginning of chapter 3, Job begins to curse the day of his birth. And he gets a discussion, and this gets a discussion going between him and his friends. And this discussion became very philosophical, very deep, very depressing because of what was going on. But their words were not comforting to Job. They didn't bring comfort. They only agitated him. As you read through Job, most of the book of Job is this discourse between him and his friends. Job ends up defending himself because his friends tell him he must have done something really awful, that God has brought this down upon him, and God is rejecting him. But yet Job maintains his innocence. But yet he does question God's intentions. After all these discussions that Job goes through with his friends, God finally speaks to Job and sets him straight concerning his intentions and who he is. And he also rebukes Job's friends because they presumed to know what was taking place in Job's life, that this was happening. They had this spiritual arrogance as though they knew God's mind and why God was doing this to Job. So what's interesting is Job's gone through all this stuff, and God tells Job, you got to pray for your friends. So Job prays for his friends. But then following that, Job gives back all that he had lost and doubles that. He lives happily ever after. And we say, wow, what a great story. Glad it's Job, glad it's not me, but what a great story. But ask yourself this, if you were in Job's shoes, how would you have reacted? Would you have been able to say, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away? Or shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Or would you curse God because what he has done is not fair? Or would you reflect on, wow, what sin did I commit that God is punishing me for, that he's doing this stuff to me? But we're going to look at this today and look at some life lessons for us that we can pull out of this as we look at who Job is. The first life lesson we want to look at today is there is an adversary that is championing for our souls. And the whole point of that adversary is to alienate us from God and to alienate God from us. This adversary's entire purpose is to separate us from God. When you look at Job, that's exactly what he was doing. He wanted Job to curse God. And a lot of us don't want to hear that, don't want to face that, because that frightens us. But it's a fact, it's a truth. And if you look at 1 Peter 5:8, it says, Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. He is actively seeking out those that he can go after, that he can devour. He does that to us just as he did with Job. He's going to use our circumstances to drive a wedge between us and God. That's what he's trying to do with Job. And, you know, I don't think any of us here have ever gone through the extent of what Job has gone through. But as we look over our lives and the different things that have taken place, we realize that Satan uses those. You have to remember, sometimes it's not as blatant as what it is with Job. Sometimes they're very subtle things that sneak in. And before we realize it, he's gotten that foothold in us. It says he prowls around, and if you've ever owned a cat or have watched a cat and you watch what they do, they're very quiet. They sneak up. I worked on a farm for years, and it was always fun to watch them go after mice because mice are pretty quick. But they would get so close, and that mouse didn't even realize they were there, and they would pounce before the mouse even realized it. That's exactly what Satan does with us. It can be these subtle things, this quiet sneaking up, and boom, he jumps. I was reading an article about the great white shark that hunts off the coast of Central California. And the author said they return year after year to the same place. And they will put a dedicated effort into a single attack. A shark will stalk its prey. They'll stay 3 to 10 feet from the surface. So they'll stay in shallow water. And they will wait up to 3 weeks waiting for their prey before they'll attack. And there was a man named James Robinson who was a sea urchin diver. And he was doing what he had done hundreds of times, what his daily routine was. He was treading water and he was taking off his diving gear when the shark came up. Got him by the leg, almost severed his leg. And unfortunately, he ended up dying from that. We go about life doing what we do. We go to work, we go to school, we do whatever we do. And sometimes that attack comes and we're not even prepared for it. We're not ready. And at these times, our only defense is going to be our faith. Job realized that even though all the things have been taken away from him, he can still stand firm on the promises of God. Think of all that he had lost, and yet he still knows that he can stand firm on his faith. Chapter 19, verses 25 through 27, Job says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. After my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me. Job senses, because he doesn't know the plan of what's going on here, but Job senses that this disease is going to bring death to him. But he knows that when that time comes, he is going to stand before his Redeemer. His faith allowed him the opportunity to see beyond all that he was going through, to know that he was going to stand before God. And I'm just going to encourage you today, don't let Satan take that away from you. Whatever it is that you are going through or what is coming, don't allow Satan to take that faith from you, because that's exactly what he wants to do. He seeks to devour, and he will use whatever circumstances that you are in or what circumstances you're going to be in to use that to devour you. The second life lesson we want to look at today is these struggles or situations can be used to shame us. Look at what Job's wife said to him. Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. She's telling him to give up. Look at the mess you're in. You might as well just give up and die. But then as these friends come along and they start talking to him, they say some pretty strong things to him. We're going to look at a couple of those. In chapter 4, verse 7, his friend says, consider now, who, being innocent, has ever perished? Were the upright destroyed? Do you see what they're saying to Job? If you were innocent and upright, none of this stuff would be taking place in your life. God wouldn't have done this to you if you had been a godly man. So they're using this to shame him into making him feel as though he had done something. In chapter 5, verses 2 and 3, resentment kills a fool and envy slays the simple. I myself have seen a fool taking root, but suddenly his house was cursed. Again, he's implying that Job is resentful against God and that harm is going to follow him. And then when he calls him a fool, it says, you're paying no attention to God. So he's using these situations to say, well, you've got to get yourself straightened out here, buddy. In chapter 5, verse 11, the lowly he sets on high, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. Verse 17, blessed is the man who God corrects, so do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. Again, he's implying that Job needs to be humble and that God is correcting him for what he's done, whatever sin that they think that he has done, that God's correcting him. And then I thought this was kind of interesting. He ends his little speech with this: "We have examined this, and it is true. So hear it and apply it to yourself." They've taken on that authority of God. And they, in the process, though, they have wounded Job by making him feel as though he's like the lowest man on the earth. His friends have taken the place of God, and they're using that authority to shame him into believing something that wasn't necessarily true. Read a story about a man, his name was Lonnie Edwards, and he was a physical education instructor, and he was teaching his fifth grade class square dancing. And as with square dancing, they pair the boys with the girls, and of course kids don't like that kind of stuff, but one little girl ran off to the side and she was crying. And he just figured it was typically, you know, girl doesn't want to hold a boy's hand. So he went over to talk to her, and she said she wasn't coming, but she was also holding a towel over her hands. He talked to her and asked her, you know, what's going on? And here, she removed the towel from her hands. She'd only been born with her pinky fingers and two partial fingers. Now, all through school, she's in fifth grade, all through school, they didn't even know this. The teachers had no clue, but the students in the class did. And what do you think they did? They made fun of her. They teased her. They shamed her because of this, in their eyes, this deformity. She wasn't normal. So he told her to hold her head up, and that from that moment on, not to use this as a limitation any longer. She gave him the towel, and he didn't return it to her. So he became her dance partner. And the kids watched this. And because of this, those kids decided that they wanted to be her partner. And they weren't afraid to hold her hands, even though they were missing these fingers. Today, she's a grown woman. She's learned to play the piano, and she can type 65 words a minute. She's married and has 4 children. But what she said was that she grew up because of one man. And why was that? Because he didn't shame her. He didn't tell her, well, yeah, you can't dance. He told her, don't let that limit you. He wasn't going to allow what those kids had said to that young girl to hold her back any longer. As we are shamed into things, what that does is it isolates us. It pulls us away from people because we don't want anybody to know. What are people going to think? How are they going to look at me? So we isolate ourselves, which is exactly what Satan wants us to do, that adversary wants to do that, because once he isolates us, there's nobody speaking any truth into us, nobody speaking any love or encouragement into us. What did that little girl do? She ran off to be by herself. She felt shamed. And that's exactly what Satan wants us to do. He will use our circumstances to shame us, because if we have troubles going in our families or whatever, we don't want people to know because it doesn't make us look as good of a Christian as we should. So we throw off to ourselves. And people, whether their intentions are good or not, can take our circumstances and they can use that to shame us. Now, this is not to say that we shouldn't be held accountable. We need to be held accountable for those things. But there's a way to be doing that. We're called to encourage each other. Hebrews 3, 12 through 13 tells us, "See to it, brothers, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness." We have to be very careful that we don't fall into that trap that Job's friends did, where we take God's authority and we make it our own. Because if you look at Job 42:7, God says to Eliphaz, "I'm angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has." We need to be very careful what authority that we take as we are dealing with those that are going through struggles in their lives. There's a big difference between shaming somebody, making them feel bad, and encouraging somebody and loving them and walking alongside them to help them through this. Job's friends had a greater calling at this time, but yet they didn't do it. Galatians 5:13 shows us what we should do when we have friends that are in those situations, or family members, whoever it may be. "You, my brothers, were called to be free, But do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command: love your neighbor as yourself. If you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. Love your neighbor as yourself. We hear that all the time, but what does that mean to us? That means that we have to put ourselves in the situation that person, say, if it was me, how would I want to be treated? Would I want somebody talking down to me, shaming me, or do I want somebody to come alongside and love me and care for me and help me through this time? Because if we devour each other, we're going to destroy each other. And that's not what we're supposed to do. We're called to build up. We're not called to destroy. We're called to come alongside and pray with those that are in need. We need to make sure as we talk with our friends or our family, whoever it is, that when we talk, it's coming from the heart of God and not out of our own flesh. Because when it comes out of our own flesh, we get that little thing in there, that little superiority thing, like, wow, it's not happening to me. Thank goodness. And we tend to start to look down because it makes us feel better about ourselves. So we have to be very careful in those situations. Our third life lesson today is whatever it is that we're going through will strengthen us for the journey if we let it. God spoke to Job in chapters 38 through 41. And Job responded to him, speaking to him in humility, and he said he despised himself, repented in dust and ashes. Again, this was a sign of mourning. He realized at that point that his sufferings were part of God's purpose, even though he may not have understood what that meant at that time. If you look at the last two verses of the book of Job, it says, after this, Job lived 140 years. He saw his children and their children to the fourth generation, and so he died, old and full of years. Now, when you read that verse, it doesn't say that Job never had a struggle the rest of his life. It doesn't say he lived this fairy tale life and everything went peachy keen for him. When you look at life and you see all the things that happened, Job still had to deal with all those illnesses, things that came along. But with what he experienced, what he had gone through, equipped him for whatever it was that came along in his life. A verse that's familiar to many of us, James 1, 2 through 3 says, consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Whatever it is that we go through has a positive impact in our lives, if we let it. The testing that we endure should make us stronger, should make us pure for God. It's not to determine whether we have faith. It's to add perseverance to that faith so that whatever else comes along in our life, we have the ability to stand up against it and not curse God because of it. There's a story about an organization that offered a bounty of $5,000 for wolves that people were able to capture alive. So two men looked at this and thought, great, we can become rich by doing this. So they turned into fortune hunters and they hunted day and night in the mountains looking for wolves. Exhausted one night, they fell asleep and they were dreaming about all this fortune that they were going to get. Suddenly, one of them woke up, and as he looked around, there were about 50 wolves around them, growling, baring their teeth. So he nudges his buddy and says, wake up, we're rich. It's all in our perspective, isn't it? How we look at it. He had these wolves surrounded him, ready to devour him. In his mind, it was, we're rich. $5,000 per wolf, that's a lot of money. But we can look at it and say, oh no, I'm going to be devoured. And that's our circumstances. We can look at them with eyes that say, God can use this for His glory, or we can look at it and say, oh no, it's going to destroy me. We can look at our situations and say we're defeated, or we can look at them and say, these are areas of potential growth in our lives. And I know that's not an easy thing to say, and it's not an easy thing to do, but this is what God is trying to refine in us to get us to see that I'm not doing this to destroy you. I'm doing this to create a dependence on me. Persevere through those things. Our fourth life lesson is our circumstances can draw us into the presence of God. In the final chapter of Job, he responds to God who had just spoken to him. And this is Job's response to God. I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You ask, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I do not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Job, as well as his friends, have seen God differently than they have ever seen God before. He says, my ears had heard of you. So they heard. They knew of God because of what they had heard. But now they're saying, my eyes have seen you. Job has seen God in a completely different way, in a way that has strengthened his faith and has given him a deeper spiritual understanding. And how did that happen? All through the trials and the tribulations that he had gone through. How often have we questioned God's motives? Because we have only heard of him instead of seeing him. Have we seen him as being distant and aloof as we go through struggles? Do we blame him? Do we accuse him? Do we curse him? Max Davis shares a story about a friend of his. Max himself was going through some difficult times, but he had a friend, Jimmy, whose wife died unexpectedly. Jimmy came home one day and found an ambulance parked in his driveway. He runs in the house, and the paramedics were performing CPR on his wife, 31 years old, very healthy, rushed her to the hospital, and as he got to the hospital, the doctor met him and said that his wife had suffered an aneurysm and had died. He became overwhelmed. And he cried out, why, God? As the weeks went by, he became very deep in despair. But through the strength of his friends, the encouragement of his friends, his parents and others, he was able to get through day by day. But he said, what spoke to him was 2 Corinthians 12:19. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And we hear that all the time and we use that. But listen to what he said. This was Jimmy's response. He said, if we had not been asked to walk through the darkness of night, we would not know the sufficiency and depth of his grace. Many times through the years, I felt God's silence, and I've wondered what purpose it serves. God has put within our lives pain to remind us of our dependency on him, and scars to always recognize that I am dependent on him. Imagine being able to say that. And Max talks about his friend, and he says his faith is stronger than ever. Jimmy has looked at his opponent square in the eyes and has not run. Yet he has experienced great grief, sorrow, and temptation he knows well. He's felt the noose of discouragement pulled tightly around his neck, and he absorbs the blows of loneliness. But Jimmy is winning by the power of Christ. God's grace and strength have become his closest allies. Is your experience with God just what you hear? Or is it something that you have experienced within your life that draws you to him? He's using these events in our lives to draw us closer to him so that our dependence becomes on him and not the things that we so often put our dependence in. Are the events in your life destroying you? Are they pulling you down? Are they weighing you down? Or are they drawing you closer to God? Where's your dependence? Job challenges me. He scares me because I don't want to go through what Job did. The thought of losing one child, much less 10, overwhelms me. But yet he allowed it to impact his life, that he drew into the presence of God instead of pushing him away and allowing that adversary to win. Because that's exactly what Satan wants to do. He wants to win. So I'm going to encourage you today, and I don't know what's going on in your lives. You do. God knows. But Do not allow those things to put a distance between you and God, because that's exactly where Satan wants to move into. Don't allow that adversary to win. Don't allow it to separate you. Allow it to build your life in Christ. He wants to use these things to strengthen you for the journey ahead, because you know what? None of us here know what was ahead. Job didn't know. It's easy for us to look at Job and say, well, he knew. No, he didn't. He had no clue what was going to happen to him. So he was facing an extremely uncertain future, just as each one of us are sitting here. No matter how well we've planned out our future, we have an uncertain future. But allow those events as they come along in our lives, and they will come along. Scripture tells us it's going to happen. But allow it to purify us, to strengthen us, but to pull us into the presence of God. Our worship team is going to come and sing the final song for us. Just want to encourage you to lay those things before God. Whatever it is that is weighing heavy on you, whatever struggles and situations you're going through, allow God to be in that, because once He's in it, you will be strengthened for the journey.